to the final season finale episode of Logic Gate. I am your host, Doug Crawford, and with me, as always, are my friends, Scott Baker.
Hello.
And Jason Nugent.
Oh, how the tables have turned.
Yeah, you didn't see that one coming. Stole the outro, now I'm stealing the intro.
All right, are you going to do the rest of the episode, too?
No, I turn it back over to you.
Oh, I see how it is. All right, fair enough. All right, we are discussing the finale, which is entitled Rick's Road, R-I-X Road. Before we get too far into this, is there anything we want to recap or retcon from the last one? Anything that came up between then and now? I don't have anything.
I do want to just mention a couple of things that I was wrong about.
Whoa.
I'm interested.
Hang on, let me get comfortable.
Well, we'll go into it, but like the idea that Luthen not wanting to kill Cassian explicitly, like him versus Clea, I mean, I'm just going to get it out of the way. I was wrong.
You're front loading all of your mistakes.
B2 having a big moment. You know, I was like very sure that B2 was going to have like some sort of crazy moment, but not really.
Well, he had a moment, but it wasn't a crazy something, character reveal.
Something, yeah. Just not nearly what I thought it would be. So those are things that I was wrong about. I mean, the intro music as well. I usually comment on this. Did you guys notice it was different this time?
It caught me off guard this time because I wasn't sure what it does not sound, you know, produced, or it didn't sound, you know, Hollywoody, I guess. It was clearly like before I, you know, because it plays before the episode, so I didn't know what the source of it was, but it's a big band like you would hear at a high school or whatever, like a marching band style, kind of like this haunting. Mm-hmm. So I wrote down that the music is a big band funeral dirge ? Is what my notes said. And I'm pretty sure it was the exact music that they play as they march through barracks.
Yes.
Right.
You revealed it right away. That was excellent. Like the big moment for me. But it's like the same. I think it's the same chord progression. I'm not like super good at picking those out. I don't know about you, Doug. You're good at that. Did you notice that?
Full honesty, no, I didn't actually catch it. I'll be 100% honest. I usually don't have my 100% full attention during the very intro. Usually that's like, you know, yelling at the kids to be quiet or, you know, the cats to stop chasing back and forth. I'm still kind of settling in. So no, I did not catch it.
Well, yeah, fair enough. You're just missing out at one of the best parts of the show. It's doing something so special, and you have family that you have to like deal with and stuff. I don't know. So
I love my kids.
I guess. And,
yeah.
What I'm taking away from this is that Doug loves his children more than he loves the intro music to a Star Wars TV show.
That's
unacceptable.
Fair.
That's unacceptable. Anyway, yes, there's like drums and horns, and I got like kind of a sense of like military type music, or like I looked it up. There's a thing called martial music, or like battle music, where it's like bugles and like, you know, drums. Like there's a drum beat and stuff like that. So.
I want to listen to it again now that I've seen the episode, because it really sounded like the music they play while they march through Ferrix. So,
I think it is almost.
I wonder if they cut it from that and made it the intro, or if they, you know, played it separately. But yep,
there's a part
seem fitting.
Yeah, there's a part in the funeral that I think is exactly the same chunk from the intro. I think, but I haven't compared them one to one, but. Yeah, this is like one of the coolest things to me is like last episode you heard like a little harmonica and a little squeak, almost like a horn, and then this is you got like full blown horns and drums and like almost an orchestra. I don't know. I think it's pretty cool.
This was the most like out of place one. So like when this played, like I kind of did a double take. Like wait, what is this? Because this does not sound. Like I would have expected, you know, what the other ones have, but clearly it fits into the episode. So actually, let's get into it and we'll get to that and we'll tie it all back to the intro music. Cause that's really what the show is all about is the intro music.
Hold on though. Before we even get to the intro music, I was going to just want to talk about, I don't know about you guys, but I had a lot of hype going into this, season finale, like I haven't been this invested in the finale of a season for, it seems like it's been a while. Like, this show's had me hooked. Were you guys feeling the hype coming into this?
Absolutely. Yeah, I watched it the night it, you know, it came out. Like, I could not wait. And, oh, yeah, same with you. I haven't been as excited and invested in a show since maybe, like, Breaking Bad or, like, maybe Lost. You know, Lost back in the day, we would, like, we'd have watch parties and watch the finale together and stuff like that. Yeah, it's been a while since I felt that.
I was super into this, but I'll be honest, I was really nervous for the finale because there's so many stories up in the air. Like, I was not convinced that they could, you know, give me satisfactory closure on all of them. I was worried you're going to have the Lost effect where, like, oh, there's a polar bear on this island, but nothing is ever explained, or what, you know, like, there was just so many story elements that don't get wrapped up. So I was trepidatious going into this, whether or not they'd be able to pull it off. So let's get into the episode. Let's see if they did pull it off, shall we? The episode starts off. We see an Imperial ship land on Ferrix. We see Miro get off of the shuttle ship, whatever it was. And it's worth noting that the sky around Ferrix is very dark. It's in the middle of a thunder and a lightning storm. So it's very imposing, the weather is. And it's very dark and glooming. We see Brasso at night. Again, it's dark, and he is talking to, and I forget the guy's name, the guy that heard Cassian on the radio, and they're discussing whether or not Cassian's going to come back for Marva's funeral, and Brasso says he'd be insane to come back now. We see, so it's all rapid fire. You see a bunch of quick scenes of they're just setting up who is on Ferrix, because the entire episode centers around the planet of Ferrix. We see Cinta following Miro and her escort through town. So we know Cinta is aware that Miro has arrived, and she's sort of shadowing her through the town. We see people in a bar talking about Cassian and how Cassian doesn't know that Marva is dead, or at least the people of Ferrix don't, because the whole town is preparing for her funeral.
Before the bar scene, there's also a little chunk of Willman wiring. It's actually the very first shot is of Willman, the son of Salmon Pak, who was tortured and killed.
That was going to be the very next thing. So intercut with all those scenes is a young boy, and he's soldering, and you get the impression he's making bombs. So it flashes, you know, literally like 5 seconds of him soldering, and then it cuts back to those other scenes. But that was one of the notes I took, was I don't know who this character is. I haven't seen him before. So this is Pak's son, you're saying?
Yeah, he's got like a hologram of him in there that kind of is supposed to hint. But yeah, I guess it's not super, he's not like a prominent character, but
right,
they're trying to give you the hint that, yeah, his dad was tortured and killed. So he is, you know, taking things into his own hands.
He has been on the screen before. It's not like they're just, you know, pulling him out for this one episode. We have seen him.
Okay, yeah. Maybe I just didn't recognize him.
I don't think he's had any speaking lines, maybe. He's been quiet, but yeah, anyway.
Does he even have a line in this episode? I don't think
he does. Not sure.
They'd have to pay him more, so they probably didn't give him a line. The next thing we see Mon Mothma in her car, and she's sort of frustrated. And Perrin, her husband, walks out, and she immediately tells Cloris, their driver, that they want privacy. And, you know, he hits a button or whatever in the window. You know, he's supposed to be shutting off the voice so he can't hear them. And she immediately lays into him and accuses him of gambling, which I thought was really interesting. Mm-hmm. And he basically says, you know, I'm not, that's crazy. Why would I get, you know, like, where would I get the money? And she was like, yeah, that's exactly what I was worried about, you know? And so ultimately he tells her that someone tell me who's telling you that I'm gambling, because they're lying to you. They must have an ulterior motive. But clearly he has some sort of past history with gambling, and it was a problem in their relationship. The whole situation was kind of weird, but ultimately I think the crux of that particular scene was that it cuts up to the driver's cabin, and Cloris, the driver, is indeed listening to all of their dirty laundry, and that comes back later.
Yeah, Mon specifically tells him to, you know, turn off the microphone or, you know, mute us so we can have a private conversation, and then perform what does a performance, I think, to, because she knows that the driver is still listening in at that point, and so she's making a show of Perrin's gambling problem, and this gives her like plausible deniability for maybe some money, the money issue, and you know, this actually comes up later when the driver's talking to Blevins about it.
I didn't get that at all. So you're saying that whole thing was an act because she knew the driver was listening?
Dude, she is throwing her husband under the bus, like setting him up as the fall guy for the missing money.
Yes.
I mean, it makes total sense when you explain it, but I did not put that together when I was watching the episode. She was very convincing. She convinced me.
Yeah, well, I mean, it wasn't explicit. There was no explicit thing that said, oh, she's just doing this for show. But, it's pretty obvious to me that she was doing that. And just the look on her face was kind of embarrassed. And she did not enjoy having to do that, it seems, but that is her plan, I think, to cover her tracks for, you know, people are going to be talking about.
So maybe that implies that she knows that he's listening and reporting back.
Yes.
Yeah. That was actually a beautiful, subtle payoff, because they hinted in like one of her first appearances with Luthen's shop that the driver might be a spy, because she's like, I got a new driver. And then we saw Luthen's assistant like pull the driver away and distract him. And so we've been a little suspicious all season that the driver is spying on her. And then we get the confirmation payoff, very like subtle, just, yep, he is. And she knows it. And she's manipulating him. It was cool.
It was a really, now that you explain it like that, it was a really well done scene, because that was very much show, don't tell. Like, you know, in a lesser TV show, they would have, I mean, they would have like laid it out shot for shot, line for line, exactly what the driver was doing. But this was very much more subtle. Yeah, so
I think it's really, like you said, it's well written, show, don't tell. And it lets all the people that do catch it feel smart and superior to the people who didn't catch it.
Clearly, anyone who didn't catch that really doesn't know what they're talking about. They definitely shouldn't have a podcast dedicated to this whole show. All right, so
there was also the bar scene. You mentioned it really quickly. I just wanted to like double check emphasize the character of Nurchi is the black dude who Cassian owed money to from, I think, maybe the first episode.
Yeah, I think so.
And so he is kind of trying to snoop around and trying to find out things about Cassian. He's the one that noticed Zan talking with Brasso in the night. And so he approaches Zan at the bar and says, hey, I'll booze you up a little bit, and gets hints of things. But, you know, he covers his tracks by saying like, hey, I don't want to know anything about Cassian, but he's obviously learning things. And I noticed, actually, I'm not sure if I picked this up from other like Easter egg shows or whatever, because I've been watching lots of other content about the finale, which is fun. But there was that moment back when Cassian returned to Ferrix and talked to Bix at night. It was at that time when he was trying to convince Marva to leave with him. And this is right before he goes to Neimos. He says he's going to give Bix some money to pay off a few folks in town. One of them is Nurchi, but Bix never makes it to Nurchi to pay him. So she gets, you know, she gets picked up by the Empire and tortured. Oh. So that kind of little thing, you know, it's just nice, a little breadcrumb that shows, you know, this character of Nurchi, you know, some motivation for him, you know.
You ready to move on?
Yes.
Talk about the bar? Okay. So the next thing we see, it cuts to Cinta and Vel, and they are in, I guess, Cinta's apartment or house on Ferrix, where she's been holed up and watching Marva. And Vel is a little bit frustrated that Cinta didn't come and pick her up. I assume she was supposed to meet her at the bus station or whatever. I did note that Vel looks very dirty and poor in this episode, so she's clearly, I would say, had a little dressing down since her time on Coruscant, living the high life. She's back to looking like she did on Aldani. So she'll fit right in Ferrix. I assume that's just part of her trying to blend in with the locals of Ferrix. Even while Senta and her are discussing Senta not picking her up, Senta continues to look out the window and with these binoculars. She is very, very dedicated to the cause, and she's pretty much not even really paying any attention to her girlfriend, very much to Vel's dismay. We see a quick scene of Cassian sneaking around the alleys. Again, it's dark and it's still night, so he's arrived on Ferrix and he is trying to sneak into town to do, we don't know exactly what he's trying to do yet. At one point, it flashes back to his dad, Clem, who was the guy in the second episode where Marva saves him from the ship. So ultimately her dad or Marva and that other black guy were his, I guess, pseudo adoptive parents. They, you know, they flash back to him cleaning parts. They're running like a junkyard kind of thing. And they're talking about his dad makes mention how they salvage old car parts and sell them for more credits than they, you know, bought them for, or acquired them for. But the interesting line that it kind of ends on is his dad says, "We don't abandon the past." Well, his dad's talking about car parts. He's like, "Hey, these are old parts, but they're still good. We can sell them." But in the present context, you see Cassian thinking about, you know, he can't abandon Marva on Ferrix. He really didn't want to leave the first time. Now that he's left and she's dead, he's feeling doubly guilty. So that had a little double meaning there.
Nice catch. That's it felt a little bit to me on the first viewing like a bit of a superfluous scene, but explaining it like that adds some context that I hadn't considered. So nice catch.
It's a super quick scene. I appreciated it, you know, because it was, you know, I don't even know, maybe a 20-30 second scene, and it gives Cassian a little bit more motivation for risking his butt going back to Ferrix. We see Cassian sneak into Pegla's, and he has two, I guess they're dogs. I don't know what sort of weird race they are, but there's these two dogs that are essentially tied up, and they start barking, and Cassian pulls his gun on him. He's just about to shoot him, and then Pegla comes out and talks the guards down once he realizes, or talks the dogs down once he realizes they're Cassian's, or that it's Cassian. Cassian immediately just says, "Hey, where's Bix? You know, essentially, I'm back for Bix. I know Marva's dead, but, you know, the only other reason for me to be here is Bix." And there's kind of intercut with this scene. There's a voiceover and you hear Nemec reading his manifesto, and I can't even do it justice. It's actually a pretty well-written, interesting manifesto. So I won't even try and quote it. The one line I took away, he was talking about the Empire and how, you know, they're how full of themselves they are. And the line that I wrote down was, "Tyranny requires constant effort." So Nemec was basically saying that the Empire, eventually they will fall because it's just going to take too much time and effort to maintain this forever. What did you guys think of his manifesto?
Yeah, that was kind of the point, I think, is like he says it's so unnatural and it's brittle because it indicates fear on the part of the oppressor when they lash out on people and stuff like that. Yeah, it was pretty nice, like, montage of sequence with his voiceover, and you see, like, we see Bix and Luthen and Cassian all kind of with that voiceover.
"Tyranny requires constant effort. It breaks. It leaks. Authority is brittle. Oppression is the mask of fear. Remember that. And know this, the day will come when all these skirmishes and battles, these moments of defiance, will have flooded the banks of the Empire's authority, and then there will be one too many. One single thing will break the siege. Remember this. Try."
So one of the things that I really kind of, I don't know what word I want to use, I was a little frustrated with it, was the pacing of this episode. You alluded to it, Nuge. The nice montage with the the voiceover of the manifesto with these different scenes establishing where our characters, all the different pieces are, kind of going into what we're to assume is going to be a climax. It does a really nice job of building up the anticipation and excitement right now. And I get a little frustrated because it doesn't crescendo. It kind of really? Goes flat.
Okay, well, let's keep going. Yeah, sorry. All right. So we see, intercut through all these scenes. We know Cassian is on Ferrix. We know Miro is on Ferrix. We actually see Luthen arrive on Ferrix. Vel is on Ferrix. So essentially, like, all the heavy hitters of the show are on Ferrix. So I don't know how far we are into this episode at this point, maybe 15 minutes. And it's basically every character is on Ferrix. They're setting up for this funeral and what is clearly going to be, you know, some sort of big, big finale. We see the next thing, we cut to a quick scene with Miro and her team, and they are talking about the funeral and how the procession is going to work. So the Empire is watching very closely because this is going to be a high profile funeral. They make mention that they've loosened air traffic, pulled back uniformed patrols, and relaxed curfews. And they say that we've baited the trap. So clearly the Empire is really expecting Cassian to come back and there to be a big crescendo, I guess. So the Empire mentions that they the Daughters of Ferrix, they were allowed 30 people in the streets, and the Daughters of Ferrix pushed back and said, you know, Marva was a really popular figure around town. We need more people. So the Empire, they offered them 40 instead. So they made a little concession to maybe appease the Daughters of Ferrix. They actually call the Daughters, I think at one point Miro says, what's the Daughters of Ferrix? And one of the other Empires Empire-like goons says that, oh, the Daughters of Ferrix, they're just a social club. They're just an annoyance. Like, they don't take them seriously. They make mention that they're going to post some snipers around town and keep close eye. That the whole Empire is on high alert and they're looking for Cassian. And Miro turns down the sniper. She says, no, get the snipers down. I want him alive. Make it very clear to everyone that he's no use to me dead. I want him alive. We see a quick scene. We cut back to the...
Well, actually, quickly on that, I did have a note about the whole taking him alive thing. Okay. It's pretty cliche, you know, plot element. Like, we need to take him alive. And it doesn't have any basis in the storytelling, just like a way to make it more believable that the hero can escape like obviously lethal situations. Like, why don't they just pull the trigger type of thing. But it makes total sense here. They've built up the reasoning why she wants him. And the reason she has to keep saying take him alive, because the Empire just wants to kill everything. It seems like, you know, just like they did with Anto Krieger, they murder, you know, that I think you're probably about to talk about that. But they're just like jumping the gun, and she's trying to convince everyone around her to, like, no, we need more information. We need to figure out who's hiring this Cassian, who's he working for. You know, it does us no good just to kill him. So, yeah, it's a cliche plot element, but they build it well here.
At this point, well, I don't know if we know for sure, but I mean, Miro certainly thinks that the rebellion, that there is more to this rebellion than anybody else, right? The rest of the Empire just seems to think, you know, oh, these are just a couple stolen spaceship parts. Like, we got bigger fish to fry. Let's not look into this. So I think that goes to, like, their motivation of, like, look, this is just a nuisance. Like, I don't care about this guy. He ripped us off on Aldani, but whatever. We're going to shoot him in the head. We're going to move on. But Miro is, like, laser focused on this guy because she, I assume, just has a hunch that there is more to this. There's a bigger pattern to what this is, and ultimately we as the audience know that ultimately it forms the rebellion, but clearly Miro doesn't know that, and that's what this is building to. So she's seeing what the audience is seeing, but nobody else in the Empire really sees.
Motif, right? I mean, yep. That's been something we've seen before, where she's kind of, she sees the bigger picture and everyone else is sort of apathetic. Apathy is probably not the right term, but the Empire is not as diligent as they should be. They're arrogant. And she sees that and she gets frustrated with it. I think you're right on the nose with that. And we see that further in the whole scene that's coming up with Krieger, which, sorry for jumping the gun. But I do want to point out, as I just talked about a second ago, that rising action and intensity and pacing of the editing and the music and the manifesto, man, where was that? Like, this scene just kills that. And then to follow it up with the Krieger scene, we go from like intense like emotion to just detail, boring planning, strategic.
Really, I kind of got the impression that was on purpose. Like it's like the first whatever 15 minutes are designed to keep you on the edge of your seat, and then like they have a couple like I guess housekeeping scenes to give the audience a chance to breathe, and then it kicks back in.
I mean, I can see, yes, that was the choice they went with. I don't think it was a good choice.
Okay, all right, Doug, calling out Tony Gilroy. You're on blast, Tony.
I guess I didn't see the intensity that you see it. I saw it as more of just an inspirational kind of montage showing, interspersing all these people coming to Ferrix, and with the narration of Nimick's, you know, manifesto, sort of you see a lot of shots of Cassian listening to it, and you know, giving us the indication that he's starting to come around and sort of buy into some of this stuff. But I didn't get any like build up to like an intense moment or anything. So
really? Okay. Well, we got a lot more to go on this episode. So let's power through some of this, and then we'll talk about the big build up. The next thing we see super quick, we do cut back to the ISB, and Mon Mothma's driver is basically reporting word for word, you know, what he heard in the car back to the ISB. So we have confirmation that her driver is indeed spying on her. We cut to the ISB meeting room, that big circular room where they're all, you know, having their weekly planning meetings. And they're essentially celebrating, I guess they report that Krieger is dead. So the trap that they laid for Krieger worked, and it went off without a hitch. He never saw it coming. There were no prisoners taken at all. They were just Krieger and all of his men were just immediately executed. We're reminded that Miro is on Ferrix, that she is not at the ISB, so she would be at this meeting, but she's not there. She calls in to this meeting, so she basically like remotes into this meeting, you know, to get the details on this. And she's kind of frustrated that they didn't take any prisoners. She wanted somebody to, you know, interrogate or something. Partagaz basically tells her like, hey, you've got, you know, something to do. You're on Ferrix. You need to work on finding access. Don't worry about the Kriegers of the world.
Well, his quote is pretty awesome. He says, you're missing the point. Today was about wiping the taste of Aldani from the Emperor's mouth. You want to start a conversation? Find access. You know, that was cool.
And so so what do we take from that scene? That the Emperor just needed a win? I mean, he needed something to... They're just trying to appease the Emperor and say we did something in response to this.
Yeah, it's like you said. They view him as a nuisance. And they just want to swat them out, and they want revenge or retribution for Aldani specifically.
You know what I take from it? I'm going to harp on this. I don't even care at this point. Wow. I take from it, like, I remember 60 seconds ago when I was hearing Nemec's manifesto, and I was about ready to jump up off the couch and grab a bat and go riot, and. Now I'm watching a scene that has like all the intensity of an office birthday party in the afternoon after lunch when people are half asleep. Like, oh, we killed Krieger! Yay!
You were
Sharon in accounting. No, like
you were prematurely inspired, because I mean there's a real moment that I mean later on that's where I felt that and it. Did it?
Oh, so when you feel it is genuine, and I feel it's the wrong time.
No, I feel bad that you now it's such a letdown. I guess how you experienced it, but I see where you're coming from. I guess
I don't even know how to respond to that. The next thing we see Luthen get on a hover cycle, like a motorcycle kind of looking thing, and I did note again that he is dressed in all in black, you know, with a hood and everything, sort of like he looked in the sewers. I don't know what they're going for with that, but he very clearly looks like a Sith. He looks like a Darth Vader wannabe.
He looks badass.
Yeah, he did look pretty badass. Yeah, for sure. I'm kind of surprised. I mean, I guess I'm not surprised because Stellan Skarsgård's an amazing actor, but for an older gentleman, he pulls off menacing and badass pretty well. We see B2MO leaving Marva's house, and we see Cassian and Brasso meet up in the sewers. We see Cassian basically explains to Brasso how he feels bad about Marva dying, and Brasso has a whole speech prepared for him. Cassian says, you know, I told her I would come back and I didn't, and I wasn't here for her, and he feels really bad. And Marva has basically prepared a speech for Brasso to tell to Cassian when he comes back. And so Brasso says, tell him none of this is his fault. It was already burning. He's just the first spark of the fire. So Brasso's kind of trying to talk him down a little bit, you know, because he doesn't want Cassian to do anything too rash. But clearly, well, I don't know. It doesn't work entirely. Cassian asks Brasso about Bix. Because now that Marva's dead, there's not a whole lot left for him here on Ferrix. And Brasso mentions that she was in a hotel and 3 days ago she was alive.
Yeah, the speech that Brasso gives Cassian there is, I think, really amazing. I'll probably actually insert it right here. Go.
Tell him none of this is his fault. It was already burning. He's just the first spark of the fire. Tell him he knows everything he needs to know and feels everything he needs to feel. And when the day comes that those two pull together, he will be an unstoppable force for good. Tell him. I love him more than anything he could ever do wrong.
And then, but the one line that I loved was, so he knows everything he needs to know and feels everything he needs to feel. And when the day comes, those two pull together, he will be an unstoppable force for good. I thought that was a great line.
Yeah, that whole thing was a very good speech.
And yeah, and you could tell Brasso was like really nervous to like rehearse. He's rehearsed it and he's nervous to say it back to him.
Yeah, Brasso's got a good memory. I mean, he basically remembered what she told him word for word. We see a quick shot of Mosk and Cyril on a bus inbound to Ferrix. So now we're alerted to the fact that Cyril is on Ferrix as well. So the whole gang is getting back together here.
Can someone explain to me what was up with the hat thing? I did not follow that.
I don't think there was much to it. I mean, they were just like...
They exchanged hats in the transport thing.
Oh, I don't know.
Why?
Well, okay.
There's no words in that scene, right? They literally just sit there and look out the window. Yeah. So I think exactly. Maybe they just needed something for them to do. I don't know. There's
no words in the scene on the transport where they're just looking out the window. Can we go back to the intensity of the office party?
I did not understand that either. I'm enjoying trying to figure the show out because it's not... Like you said, it's not holding your hand. It's not spilling things out like a more mainstream show might. It's trying to tell you to figure it out, or also like maybe guess what these people are doing. You know, we're just getting drop shipped into the situation. We're viewing things, and things are they're doing weird things that people would do that may not have explanation. I did watch like those Easter egg videos or whatever, and there was one explanation that I saw that was fairly convincing, was that they exchanged hats as like it may be a common protocol for their corpora police or undercover police, where they can recognize the other person more clearly when they have that hat on, when they recognize their own hat on that person. So you know, maybe it's that. But
all right,
sure.
Okay. It was the whole scene was a throwaway scene. The entire point of the scene was just to establish that Mosk and Cyril are on Ferrix.
But it's a little touch that I enjoyed, and obviously
I thought it was fine. Yeah,
Doug did not.
Well, Doug hates fun. So what are you going to do?
Could they have just done it with like some more exciting music in the background, or like you know an intense camera zoom where we get like a close up of their steel you know, glares. They're looking out the window preparing for, I mean, something. They look bored. I'm bored because they are bored.
Wow, you are not getting a Christmas card from Tony Gilroy this year. So the next thing we see, we see a bunch of stormtroopers marching through the streets. Vel and Luthen actually meet on the street, and he kind of casually asks her, is he here? And Vel replies, they think he is, and they're watching the stormtroopers, and they're watching the Empire, who are watching very closely for Cassian. And Luthen's line is, they'll do the hunting for us, they'll want him alive, they'll find him, and we will kill him.
So, yeah, she also tells him that there's an ISB supervisor there, and he guesses that it's a woman, and she's like, oh, so you know this person. So he knows that he knows Deidre Miro that Lonnie told him about in the last, I think it was last episode.
At one point you hear, or I can't remember, one of the characters mentions the anvil. And I did make note that in the first season, we kept talking about there was that weird guy with the hammer hitting the bell, but it's actually not a bell. So it's an anvil. I don't know what that means. I mean, it could have just been a bell, but they called it an anvil. It was not what I was expecting it to be. It has a name and it is not a bell. So this scene is extremely tense, I thought, because what you see, all of these characters coming together, they're all getting out into the street in public, and everyone wants Cassian dead. The Empire wants Cassian. The Miro wants Cassian. Clearly, Luthen and Vel want Cassian. But we know, as the audience, we know that he lives. I mean, he goes on to star in Rogue One. But so I know how this episode ends. You know, for whatever happens, he doesn't die. But this scene is still super duper tense to me. And I just thought that was a testament to the writing, is that, you know, even though we essentially know how this ends, I was still sort of on the edge of my seat, like, wow, there is a lot of moving pieces in this. Like, how does Cassian pull this off?
Yeah, you're saying, like, when the gong dude starts going? Like,
it's an anvil.
Yeah. Anvil, sorry. That's specifically this part of the scene?
Mm-hmm. That's when it starts to get serious. I think that the anvil is essentially the, you know, the starter pistol or whatever for the procession of the musicians coming through the audience. It's the start of the funeral.
So I watched this twice. I didn't really quite understand what was going on the first time, but the second time I realized that they pushed the funeral back 2 hours, they said. Mm-hmm. But I think they started on time. I think they started when they wanted to say, like, F you to the Empire.
Interesting.
And because they weren't ready for it. They were, like, scrambling once they heard the gong going. Sorry, the guy's awesome. They're scrambling to get things in place, and the guy's like, yeah, not sure why it's going. Even he's not even sure what that means. The banging and stuff. It doesn't seem. Tego is the, I think, precept for this area. He's like freaking out. Like, why is what's going on? And then he realizes it's starting, and I think it's ahead of schedule.
I didn't put two and two together that they were starting early, but that would make sense as their way of just telling the Empire to shove it. So interesting.
Yeah, isn't that awesome? I mean, they're just
that is cool.
Fuck you. Yeah, Empire, you can tell us when to start our funeral. Nah.
Yeah. So there's the tension continues to build. We see these musicians in the street, you know, and they're wearing their, you know, sort of, I guess, dress uniforms, and they are starting to warm up. You see some flutes and some French horns. So what you come to see is that it's a funeral dirge, and that they are going to proceed through the streets. It's worth mentioning that the title of this episode is called Rick's Road, and the road that they are processing down is indeed Rick's Road. So this is, I assume, the main thoroughfare of this town. The whole town has come out to witness Marva's funeral and just sort of see her off. And the last part of this scene is we see, and I forget what his name was, the kid that was making the bombs in the opening walks out onto the street with a bag. So, like, the tension, like, ramps up to, you know, like, 11 right here. Because already all the factions are in place. And then the last thing you see before the whole thing starts is this kid with this bag of bombs walk out. And you're like, I don't know about you guys, but I was like, oh, man. Like, this is, you know, the fit's about to hit the shan, so to speak.
I liked this sequence like this whole sequence with the building and the way it starts and the way that like the musicians are kind of just sort of tuning up and milling about, and then they, you know, start together. Everything about it is fantastic. Like an analogy I would use is this sequence feels like, oh, it's your turn in line at the roller coaster. Like you're getting in, you're getting your lap bar set, and the roller coaster is kind of rolling out onto the track. And oh, there you go. You're about to start climbing the hill and building. And yes, you know what's coming next.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Side tangent. Sorry. I just posted some pictures in our chat, and I have not seen this anywhere. I've been watching the videos and listening to the podcast. I think I may be the first to spot this. Probably not, but I think Tony Gilroy is in the marching band. There, I posted some pictures in our chat. I just
that would be a cool Easter egg if you were right. I mean, it's super easy to blend into the audience. Yeah, totally.
And he's got this horn that he's playing. It's kind of like covering his face in like wider shots that you would normally see his face. So that tells me that it's not like an actor that would want to have FaceTime on camera. I'm excited about it.
But we know Tony Gilroy is obviously listening. So shoot us an email and let us know if you were in this episode.
And if we're the first podcast,
Tony, you really have some answers. Like, we'll get there. But yeah, roller coaster's building.
All right. The Empire makes mention that they want to move some troops into position. And they want a show of force. They are clearly extremely nervous about this funeral. And at least to me, at this point, it wasn't really clear why they were so, so, so nervous. I mean, they look like they were just built and ready for a full-on riot. And up until this point, I mean, we're kind of under the impression that this is just going to be a normal funeral where they just walk through the streets. I guess the way Jason explains it, that maybe they're moving 2 hours early, that might be why the Empire was so nervous. But there's a line here where the Empire basically says that they want a show of force. They want to prove to the natives of Ferrix that they are not messing around. But before that even really happens, we get a cool cutback wide shot, and you see the musicians walking down, I forget, the left side of this street, and the Daughters of Ferrix are coming from the right hand side, so they're going to meet at this crossroads and sort of form one big procession. And you see in this wide shot just how big and how many people are there. And I think that was the first time that I really put it together, like, oh wow, okay, maybe this is why the Empire is so nervous, because there are a lot of people here, and they definitely outnumber the Empire. There are a lot of Empire people on this town, and they are heavily armed, but there are way more natives, and they are clearly on the side of Marva if they're coming out to listen to her or participate in her funeral. We see Cassian is up above. He's kind of hiding behind some facade of one of the buildings, and he sees Luthen with his little scope. I think at this point, Cassian kind of does a double take, because he realizes if Luthen's here, like, this is a big deal. Because he knows that Luthen is probably not going to be too happy with him. So,
Yeah, this is the actual moment that I thought that I realized that they're playing the intro music to the show.
Yes.
with the shot of Cassian and his reaction to seeing Luthen. It's sort of his theme, I guess. And I mean, I got chills. Like, I thought this was so freaking cool to have a build up or like this, just kind of like, you know, it's an intro theme. It's barely there. It doesn't have a lot going on. Slowly morphs and changes from being kind of distorted and sparse into more full and orchestral. And then we get a payoff of it being part of this Ferrix tradition of this funeral procession with all these crazy kind of cobbled instruments. And I mean, ugh, it was just so cool. I mean, I loved it.
I'm with you. Like, the hair on the back of my neck stood up, because the very next thing you see is you see Brasso walking through the center of this procession. He is essentially at the head, I suppose, and he has a brick in his hand, and it's kind of funny shape, like almost like, it's not a rectangular brick, I should say, but it has some sort of, you know, alien language on it. I assume it says Marva and whatever the Ferrix native tongue is, or who knows. And you see And you see B2MO following him, and or at least on the side of him, rolling through the streets. And the crowd sort of, I guess, falls in place behind him.
There was a little moment there where we see Nurchi telling Korv to double the reward. I guess he knows where Cassian is, and he tells Korv to pretend to arrest him. He has, because he has information about where Cassian is. And so he, like, arrests him and, you know, so forth.
At first, I thought that was kind of like fake. Like, maybe he was going to, you know, distract the Empire. But I think he was being genuine. Like you said, if they arrested Bix before he had a chance to pay off Nurchi, Nurchi's probably still pissed at Cassian. So he wants to you know, take him out. But
oh, yeah, he's a snitch. Yeah.
Ultimately, it doesn't end up working. Well, I mean, I'm skipping over a lot of little pieces on this because there's so much in this. What we see, so at this point, there is a huge procession up the street. So the musicians and the Daughters of Ferrix have all combined, and there's hundreds of people, and they're humming the music that this funeral dirge is playing. The Empire, you see the Empire prepare their riot shields, and it's getting very tense. I mean, this is a scene that we've all seen on the news a million times of, you know, the cops lining up to repel an invading force or, you know, protect buildings or whatever. And so, you know, something big is coming. And the entire town essentially starts to chant stone and sky, which is part of whatever the Ferrix funeral ritual is. They clearly all know exactly what this means. And it has kind of a haunting effect when you hear the entire town saying this. You know, you get the impression they're all on the same side, and they're doing this while the Empire is putting up their riot shields and preparing to go to battle.
I also just want to point out the intensity has been building. The roller coaster has been climbing for about 6-7 minutes at this point. Mm-hmm. So you got to feel like, are we almost at the top yet? Are we almost there? Or at least that's where I was thinking. I was waiting for it to kick off like any second. Like, there's a lot of build up.
I was just gonna. I have to argue against Doug because he's very cynical. It seems. I think this is such a great way to build tension because a funeral is not supposed to like end in a climax, right?
This is supposed to be the opposite, right?
It's supposed to be a somber, you know, funeral, but there's a moment where the whole band pauses and then they start playing again, like a more fast, like with the flutes going quickly, and and there's a drum roll going, and it's just such a great.
And you're absolutely right. When we get to that point where everybody kind of stops, like the bands have converged and Brasso's like bringing the rock out, the brick, Marva's brick out front. And then we pause for a second there and the shot goes down to the other end of the street and you see the riot shields and the soldiers lined up. And then the music picks up and it just goes faster and you're like, oh yeah, this is it. This is all coming to a head right here. And then it doesn't.
All right, so what happens next?
It all stops. The music stops. Everyone stops walking. There's no confrontation.
No, that's the
beauty.
And
then we listen to a speech.
Yeah, but that's the beauty of this, right? Like, you are so close. Like, you want it. Like, you are right on the edge of your seat. Like, you want this. And Tony Gilroy, he's like, no, no, no. You're not ready yet. You can't handle this. Hang on one more second. And then B2MO rolls out in the middle of the street. He's now the center of attention. And he spits out, you know, a little 3D hologram, Star Wars style, and it's a full body shot of Marva. She gives, you know, essentially this amazing speech about what it means to be on Ferrix and what it means to fight against the Empire and how they've tolerated the Empire for too long, thinking things would get better, but they're not going to get better. And the note that I wrote was, do you prep these speeches before you die? I mean, she's got like a 2-minute speech or a 90-second speech, and it's really well done and well thought out. And it was a very meaningful speech. But I just imagine, you know, if you're in this situation and you're sick or you're going to die, you're like, all right, hang on, B2MO, come over here. We got to work on my funeral dirge speech. She ultimately, she gives an impassioned speech to the people and basically says, I want Ferrix to continue. There is a wound that won't heal at the center of the galaxy. There is a darkness reaching like rust into everything around us. We let it grow, and now it's here. And ultimately, she ends her speech with, it's easy for the dead to tell you to fight. So she's basically saying, look, it's easy for me to stand up here and be dead and tell you that you need to rise up against this heavily armed empire, but it's up to you guys. And right about this time, so here I think this is the crescendo that Doug was talking about. He had to put up with a 90-second speech of Marva. Excellent speech, though. Good job, Tony. Good writing.
Amazing speech, and I'm probably going to put some of it in right here.
The Empire is a disease that thrives in darkness. It is never more alive than when we sleep. It's easy for the dead to tell you to fight. And maybe it's true. Maybe fighting's useless. Perhaps it's too late. But I'll tell you this. If I could do it again, I'd wake up early and be fighting these bastards. From the start, fight the Empire.
But like my favorite is like the whole idea of like on your deathbed and kind of having regrets and saying like, if you know, I'll, like you said, it's easy for the dead to tell you to fight, but maybe it's true. Maybe fighting is useless. Perhaps it's too late. And she says, but I'll tell you this. If I could do it again, I'd wake up early and be fighting these bastards. Like,
you know, that was a pretty badass line, though.
Hell yeah. And it's just like,
yeah,
she's in the center of Rick's Road and all these people are watching her. I mean, this is amazing. This is an amazing scene. I was crying. I was like bawling on the floor right here. I mean, this is
right. So let's get to the crescendo for Doug so he can shoot it down. So Marva's speech ends, and actually I don't know if it ends, or at one point the Empire, basically they're fed up and they're like, well, this is
the
too
last
much
thing she says is fight the Empire, and the guy and Tego comes over with a coat,
yeah,
and tries to put it on the droid to cover her up,
and like misses, like yeah. It's this huge droid, it'd be so easy to cover up, and he like only covers up like a third of it, so she doesn't like, anyway,
and then he just kicks it over. Yeah, that's the end of that.
But then the fighting starts. Like, that's the key to everybody. That's the key to both the Empire and, you know, the citizens of Ferrix. You see the Empire hold up their, they yell, hold the line. They put their riot shields up because they know that everyone's coming for them. There's a cool scene or a line where one of the Empire guys, I forget who it is, points at the tower and they basically say, take out the anvil, take out the anvil. Cause I guess the anvil somehow helps the, you know, the townsfolk coordinate. Like he's the center of this rebellion. Like, I don't think so, but it was just funny that, that was their main focus, was we got to get rid of the anvil.
Sorry, before we get into the fighting, I think this is the most important part of this whole show is Marva's speech. And there's different shots of like Luthen reacting to this speech, and you see him kind of smiling, and you can see him kind of like reconsidering things or just like reacting to the situation. You also see Willmann, who created the bomb earlier. You see him like crying during this moment. I mean, you see all these people reacting to her, and you see Brasso looking up at the hologram and being like, yeah, you know what? I mean, he's not even like a rebel or anything, but he's like, wait a sec. Yeah, you're kind of right about this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Same with Zan. Zan also is just sort of the Zamin or Zan, who the transport dude that helped casting a few times. Like, he's not a he's just trying to get by kind of guy, but he was looking at that and he was starting to get inspired. So you see like all these people that are not normally rebellion people, but they realize, you know, this speech really brings out something in all of the people there. So keep going.
Doug, do you have any, want to give you a platform here.
Yeah, no, to me, like this fake first crescendo was the moment where I realized B2 Emo was going to be just a useless droid. He wasn't going to do anything cool. Like, this was his moment, and nothing.
I mean, yeah, the droid was very underwhelming, I will say that for sure. But I guess, you know, he was evoking like R2 and in that hologram. R2 when he projected the hologram of Leia in New Hope, like the whole, yeah, Obi-Wan, I need, you know, you're my only hope type thing. Yeah. So it's kind of, I think, is evoking that mostly, but that's the extent that the droid gets for sure.
I mean, they go through such a huge buildup of his emotion and to show his closeness in his relationship with Marva. And, you know, this would have been his opportunity to, you know, rebel against the Empire, you know, out of his, you know, closeness with Marva. And instead, no, nothing. He just sits there like a...
Well, he gets knocked over even. He just gets knocked over, too.
Yeah. Why doesn't he just go roll back home and charge some more? Useless droid.
Wow.
The next thing we see is, I forget, the kid that was making the bombs throws a bomb. And your first indication as the audience is like, he's throwing this right at the line. He's just going to blow these guards up, right? But actually, he throws it way over the line, like about 20, 30 feet behind them. And I was like, oh, well, he totally overthrew that. And then all of a sudden, you see it actually blows up a tank or something they had behind it that is full of other, I assume, grenades or explosive, which causes an even larger explosion. So at this point, there is just mass chaos in the streets because the people are rioting. The Empire can't hold the line. There's now this huge explosion behind their line. So they're sort of flanked on both sides. They don't know really what to do. At one point, the Empire, one of the guys just yells, "Open fire." And they just start firing on this unarmed crowd in really kind of a dark way. I mean, clearly the citizens of Ferrix are unhappy, but none of them, at least that I could tell, showed up armed. They didn't have pistols. I mean, they didn't even have rocks, really. And all the Empire just starts open laser fire on this crowd. We see Brasso headbutt one of the stormtroopers. Yeah. I mean, that looks cool in movies, but I always shake my head every time I see it. I mean, have you ever headbutted anybody or anything? Like, it is not pleasant. You're not going to walk away from that and then also go fight the rest of this. I mean, it was a cool moment for him, but it's very Hollywood.
Can't you headbutt somebody with like the crown of your head, like the real point?
I'll tell you what,
get a good you know, knock out of that.
Why don't you do some research and try that and let us know?
Okay. Well, in that moment, he's actually saving Willman. Willman is being dragged away by two stormtroopers, and I think he uses the brick against one of them, and then headbutts the other. So he's able to save Willman at that point. Yeah.
So
wait, did I miss that? You're saying he uses Marva's brick as a weapon?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Oh, I missed that. That's awesome.
Yeah, no, she's fighting in her own figurative way.
Oh, that's even cooler.
Yeah, there was actually another small thing. At first I was a little bit bothered with the throwing of the bomb and like kind of thought, oh, he just hit the luckiest throw of all lucky throws, you know, just happens to hit that, you know, box of grenades.
Yeah, don't you just hate it when your grenades spill out and blow up? I mean, that's awful.
It is a bit over the top, but it's also symbolic. I can understand the choice because it's supposed to symbolize how, you know, it's a chain reaction. One spark can cause a ripple effect and set off more sparks, more explosions. So, okay, I was able to buy that a little bit. What I didn't care for was the fact that that was the true crescendo. What we got before with them like charging into the riot soldiers, you realize that that was not actually, it felt less intense than it should have been. The real intensity was with the bomb going off. That was the highlight, the high point of the entire episode and season, for that matter. that's where the roller coaster kind of tips over, and now you're starting to, you know, free fall.
You didn't like that?
I didn't like what happened right after the bomb went off, which was about 60 seconds of silence and everyone slowly getting up and dusting themselves off. Like, how are you going to follow up the most intense action with absolutely nothing? Pacing. Pacing, my dude.
I thought that was genius because
it was driving me crazy. All of the start and stop and intensity building and backing off and
you wanted more action. But I felt like that's really true to, you know, like being shell shocked in the army. I mean everything I know about that kind of thing was playing Counter-Strike when you throw the flashbangs, right? I mean, like, that was like essentially the biggest flashbang that could have gone off, and it affected everyone in the street, and it was extremely loud, and it was extremely bright, and it was concussive. And I mean, I think it indicated that it affected the Empire and it affected the citizens of Ferrix, and they were all just completely, A, they were caught off guard, and B, they were all shell-shocked, like, what's going on? I can't fight right now because just happened.
Working. As an artistic choice, I could see that working in a vacuum if it hadn't been for all of the other start and stop and go and don't go of the previous, 35 minutes of the episode we've been watching so far. Like, it was starting to frustrate me.
Well, there's some pretty evocative imagery there with the smoke-filled city, like, kind of 9/11-ish, like, especially with Vel running into the smoke, and that was the fog of war, so to speak, that they really needed to like get out of there without a huge bloodbath. But the imagery to me was strong in that respect.
I get the reasoning for it, I get the artistic choice, and like I said, it makes sense, and I could see it working in context of the editing and pacing of the rest of the episode. I didn't like it.
Okay.
Also, really quick, you mentioned Vel and the scene with her running into the smoke. Quick question for both of you. More useless character in this episode, B2 Emo or Vel?
Okay, I agree with you there. I think Vel and Cinta, that kind of thread kind of goes nowhere, and that's probably one of the biggest criticisms I have of the finale is like, there's just kind of nothing that happens there. I'm in agreement. As far as literally which is more least effective or whatever, still go with the droid. The droid's whining about not being effective. At least Vel doesn't talk that much.
Yeah.
All right, so we got to get back on track. We're going to go way long. There's a lot.
No, we're almost done.
We're good. We're good. Okay. We see a scene, and maybe you guys can explain this to me. Cinta follows an Empire guy kind of up in this alley, and he turns around and he catches her following him. And he's like, you know, what are you doing? You shouldn't be back here. And she just straight up stabs him in the gut and throws him in a building and closes the door to hide him. So
yeah, that's Corvo.
It was Corvo. Corvo, according to the subtitles. Who was that and why was she following him?
That was Daedra's assistant, who's been there staking things out for Daedra specifically and has been meeting with her. And okay. Yeah.
He was the intelligence guy on the planet, right?
Gotcha. Okay. What we see intercut through this last couple scenes, we've seen several scenes of Cassian, who has now broken into the hotel. He is going to go rescue Bix, which seems like the most insane thing to me. Like, I understand there's a million Empire on this planet and they're probably all down at this funeral, but like him trying to go like one man, you know, John Wick style up to this hotel to rescue Bix was crazy. But ultimately he makes it to the top. He runs into a guard at the top and he like punches the guard and he does like this cool hip flip, throws the guard on the ground and just straight up executes him with his gun on the ground. So, I mean, we're back to Cassian shoots first, like no hesitation. He just executes this guard, which was kind of cool.
It makes sense that it's kind of easier right now because everyone is focused on the street and the rabble that's going on there. So there's a lot less soldiers in the hotel itself, I think. So
We see Cassian ultimately gets Bix up and out and walking. She is initially she's doesn't want to leave. You get the impression that she's, you know, shell-shocked, and she was more coherent than I expected her to be. I expected Cassian to get to her and her just to be a shell of a human and there'd be nothing left to rescue. But he's able to have a conversation with her, and he does ultimately get her up and walking out of the hotel. So they're going to attempt to make a run for it. We see a cut back to the scene in Ferrix in the main road, and all hell has broken loose, and Miro actually gets her gun out, and she's going to shoot into the crowd because things are so crazy, and she takes a rock in the head, so she never gets a chance to shoot at anyone. But so Miro goes down on the ground, and you see Cyril rescue her. Ultimately, the crowd was going to mob her and rip her apart, but Cyril is able to rescue her and pull her to the side before she gets destroyed. There's a really cool scene. I really like this, actually. And it's totally over the top Hollywood, but one of the stormtroopers makes it to the top of the tower, and he's going to like try and shoot the anvil guy to, you know, shut down the anvil or whatever. And the anvil guy just like full on, this is Sparta, like kicks the stormtrooper off of the tower, which was great.
I loved that. Yeah.
That's ultimately the end of the fighting. Everyone has essentially now dispersed.
Wait, did you talk about Karn saving Daedra?
Yeah, I didn't.
We
didn't cover that, did we?
Cyril, yeah. So Miro takes the rock to the head. She hits the dirt.
Oh, right.
And then Cyril rescues her before the mob destroys her. It's going to rip her limb from limb.
Oh, so you skipped over the amazing sexual tension
that they had together. Right.
Which was, I thought was amazing. Like just super weirdly awkward, like it has been with them, those characters, but they have some like real chemistry. You know,
she pulls her gun on him at one point. Right. And she's like freaking out, like, who are you? And then she's like, oh, it's you. And then they stare longingly into each other's eyes, and mm-hmm. they fall in love and start planning the babies they're going to have. And yeah, it was a weird scene. They have like the creepiest, weirdest relationship.
Well, she's so embarrassed because she's normally in control. She loves being in control. Yeah. And like she's being rescued by this dork. And I think she just hates the situation. But also something about it is like getting to her, and like the fact that this guy actually cares about her.
She's visibly shaking. I mean, like her face and her body, like she's like her adrenaline is going so much, and she's so angry and crazy and doesn't know what to do and doesn't know how to handle it. Like she's, you know, whatever, they're 6 feet, you know, they're 6 inches away from each other's faces, and she's losing it trying to figure out if she wants to kill this guy or kiss him. And yeah, it was a great but really weird scene.
In some ways, it did kind of mirror, like, in the beginning of the season, when Cyril went and saw action, so to speak, for the first time in his career. You know, there was a firefight that broke out. He was the wide-eyed, scared newbie. And I kind of got the impression that this was her first time, you know, in the action and not just analyzing data in an office somewhere. Yeah,
I got that impression too. Like her job before this had been starching her uniforms and updating spreadsheets. Like I don't think she'd ever like fired her pistol.
So it was an interesting juxtaposition. You know, we get to see how far he's come in his confidence and, you know, see her flipped upside down. Like she's always been the dominant, confident person, you know, controlling the whole room and telling people what to do, and now she has zero control and she's helpless. He's in control. It was an interesting
turn
for their characters. Also really intense and exciting. And then we followed that up with one more scene.
No, there's three more scenes. Yeah, so let's power through. There's last couple scenes. So there's 4 more scenes, and they're all essentially housekeeping. Vel and Cinta are cleaning out Cinta's place.
I'm just going to flat out say I don't care.
Yeah, I didn't really care either. It was kind of just anyway, the point is that Cinta's leaving, and Vel asks, you know, what are we packing? And she says, everything goes. We see a scene with Mon Mothma Perrin and her daughter in their apartment. the doors open and they're meeting Davos Skulden, his wife and their son, for this planned meeting that Mon Mothma is going to have to do to make the 400,000 credits disappear. I did make note that, did you guys get serious Jedi vibes from Mon Mothma's daughter? Because she's dressed all in white robes with like a brown belt. I mean, she totally looked like something you would have seen like a Padawan training.
That did not come to me at all, no.
Okay, I mean, so the two things that were really obvious to me was Luthen dressed all in black, looks very much like Kylo Ren or Darth Vader. It's just very typical of a Sith. And then Mon Mothma's daughter, it was just a weird outfit. You know, maybe it's just a regular ceremonial outfit. I don't know. But the point is that she looked like a Jedi in that kind of like rough cotton outfit.
Luke wore all black in Return of the Jedi, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Did he have an exclusive Sith look? Yeah. Okay. All right. Fair enough. We see, I'm going to do these slightly out of order. We see Luthen leaving. No, I don't want to do that. We see Brasso loading his ship, and we see B2MO on the ship, and Cassian arrives with Bix and loads Bix onto the ship, and Cassian gives them some directions, you know, fly low out over this ocean, then pull up hard and fly and take off. You know, he's basically telling them how to get off this planet with all the Empire coverage. And ultimately, Cassian gets off the ship. He says, I'm not coming with you, which really caught me off guard. I'm like, dude, you got a 1 in a million chance to get out of this. Number one, you were barely able to rescue Bix. And number two, you're on a ship that can leave. Like, you're not going to get a second chance. But he says he's getting off the ship. And I was like, what's going on here? But Bix had kind of a cool line. She says, Cassian will find us. She has faith in Cassian because he's already come back and saved her once. He came back for Marva. So Bix, despite being the broken woman she is after all the torture, still has faith in Cassian.
The way she says it is like almost like he's not there. She's like kind of delirious and says like, oh, he'll find us, almost not realizing that Cassian is literally there talking to them. So she's kind of still out of it. But yeah, it's weird.
So the final scene after Cassian has left the ship and Bix and them have taken off, we see Luthen leaving town on his hover motorcycle or whatever. And his, you know, all black Sith looking uniform is now covered in dust and dirt. So he was clearly, you know, part of the explosion and he was able to escape. So we do see that he gets onto his ship after riding way out of town. And Cassian is on his ship and he kind of surprises him. And Cassian just straight up asks him, he says, you came here to kill me, didn't you? And Luthen picks up his gun and he wavers a little bit. And Cassian's the last line is, kill me or take me in. So he gives Luthen an ultimatum. He was like, look, I'm here. I'm not armed. I'm not going to fight you. What did you take away? What did you guys take away from the last scene? Because that's it. He says, kill me or take me in. And then, it's star wipe. And then we're on the credits.
Super small detail, but I want to point it out.
Sure.
Luthen picks up Cassian's gun. Cassian left his gun there for Luthen to find and to demonstrate and show him I'm unarmed. I saw that. Actually, I'm rather proud of myself on this one. I even bragged to my wife. I saw that when Luthen came in. And Cassian's gun was sitting on the table or barrel or whatever it is right there.
Yeah.
Like, oh.
How did you recognize his gun? Where did you see it before?
They showed it to us like 4 or 5 times close up as he was sneaking around.
Okay.
When he first came into the port, as he was sneaking through the tunnel, the vent, whatever it was.
There is that really slow reveal when Luthen leans down and picks up the gun. Like you see the gun. I didn't realize that it was his gun, though. That's even cooler. That's even more badass, right? Like Cassian's just like, huh.
Yeah, I didn't recognize that either. Are you indicating that maybe he disabled it somehow, or it's just showing that it's Cassian's gun? And
it's exactly what Cassian said. You know, I made it easy for you this time. You know, here's my gun right there. You can shoot me with it. He was just laying all of his cards out on the table, and that was a show of good faith. And since we're diving into this small detail, interesting that in Luthen's interaction with Saw Gerrera, he pulled a gun and threatened to shoot Saw Gerrera. Cassian's taking the exact opposite approach and like the opposite of a threat. Like, here, I'll give you the gun.
Interesting. Yeah, in a way to like get people to trust each other. It's different way. It's sort of the same scenario. It was like one in a tense situation, they're trying to like find a way to trust each other. And this is one way that Cassian's done it, and that this is a brilliant way, I think. Like he's kind of taking he's not taking a note from Luthen, but he's doing something Luthen can probably respect, is like just putting everything on the line and willing to sacrifice everything. He knows that Luthen's just going to keep going after him, I guess. So this is his gambit, is like, okay, let's just end it now. Either you take me out now, or just like make me useful. It's such a, and it's a dark scenario. It's not like happy. It's not a happy moment for Cassian. Like, oh yay, we get a new good guy, we get to join the team. No, it's like this is like the best of all bad options for Cassian. You know, the rebels are just a not even a fully formed group at this point. They're just, you know, Luthen's shown to have like really bad tactics. Obviously wants to just kill Cassian, but he's his best option, really, you know, because he sees sort of the war, the ensuing war coming. And so, this is a side he's gonna pick. And
so is he saying to Luthen, like, you can kill me right now, or I'll join your team, because otherwise the Empire is going to keep coming for me and I stand no chance?
That's not what I take from it. And I would also point out, this isn't like, well, this is the, you know, only choice he could really make. No, he's demonstrated before that he's perfectly good at, you know, changing his name, escaping, you know, blending in, staying undercover, staying hidden. That was his whole MO before.
But is he? He got arrested on Nyamos after doing all of that for nothing. Like, he's realizing,
right?
Yeah, but that he's was realizing, just a random chance.
No, I don't think he thinks it's a random chance. I think he thinks that's inevitable. Have to pick sides. This is the whole point of this show, is showing that Cassian has to pick sides. There's no choice. Otherwise, you're going to get swept up into a prison system. You're going to get killed by the Empire with their overbearing oppression. Or you have to choose a side at this point. And this is the whole point, and this is what he's doing.
I like to look at it like a character arc, a progression. He started out as the loner scavenger, just getting by, you know, taking care of himself and the people close to him. That was it. You know, he killed a couple of guards and he's like, I got to get off the planet right now. His MO was to run. And then after everything he's been through, listening to Nemec's manifesto, seeing the plight of the Aldani people, dealing with the oppression of the prison system, hearing Marva's speech urging people to rise and fight, he's finally made the choice, like, okay, I can't run anymore. This is worth fighting for. And that's what his moment in the ship is. He's not saying, oh, shit, I got to go with Luthen and the guy might kill me, but it's the best chance I have of evading the Empire. No, he's coming to Luthen proud and exposed, saying, I'm ready. You know, I'm done running. I want to fight. You know, you're the best option I have to fight these guys. Let's do it.
Yeah, we could like psychoanalyze him a lot more. I think there's an element of him just kind of being pragmatic and just saying, okay, you know, like the whole thing with Nemec's journal is the Empire is fragile, it's brittle, it's unnatural, it's not really going to survive. Maybe that's a pragmatic choice for him to say, okay, maybe this is one element of the choice that helps him make that choice. But yeah, but basically, I think from what I take of this whole series is the stakes are increasing. The lengths that the Empire is willing to go are greater and greater. And you just he's forced into choosing a side, and this is his only option, really. or at least his best option, best of the many bad options, I think.
I think, yeah, I mean, we could debate it all night. I think that this last scene, you know, that line that he has with Luthen, and I mean, there's no resolution. Neither one of them make a move for a weapon. Neither one of them nod to the other one. There's nothing. I think it's left open to interpretation on purpose. And we may not know exactly what his motivation is or where it takes him. I mean, we're not going to see. I don't think we're going to see any more Andor until 2024. So I think it's left purposely ambiguous.
Yeah, nope. I mean, you see Luthen smile in this. As far as like whether or not Luthen shoots him, obviously we know he doesn't do that.
Right.
And we obviously know Cassian joins the rebellion. And to me, it's evident in their expressions as they do the scene. So like the idea that particular cliffhanger, whether or not he shoots him, isn't up for debate for me, in my opinion.
I do want to say, you know, I see that this is open to interpretation. Like, there's no right or wrong answer. I liked your original point, Nuge. It was very upbeat, energetic, exciting. Your second point kind of plateaued a little. It didn't feel like it had that same energy. And then by the third point, it just felt like the whole thing was slowing down. And
is this some sort of analogy of some sort? Or
I'm thinking of your argument needs work.
All right. So let's see. I'm trying to figure out how we want to end this. There were several questions that left.
Well, there's a post-credit scene.
I was going to get to that at the very, very end. So there were. Let's do. I got a couple questions. So this is the end of the season one. We're not going to see season two until 2024, I believe. So we've got a while to wait till a lot of these questions are answered. But in my mind, there was a big opportunity here. To the entire series started with Cassian searching for his sister. Literally minute one of the pilot is Cassian looking for his sister. That whole plot thread is essentially ignored. I was really kind of hoping that the finale of this would be it would come full circle and somehow we would come back to Cassian's sister, but that didn't go anywhere. So one of the questions I had left that was left unanswered is, where is Cassian's sister and how does she fit into this, if at all? We were given several glimpses of Luthen's weird sword cane thing, but there's no payoff there about what that is. Is he a fallen Jedi? Is this just a weird cane that he bought at his store? Or, you know, what's going on with that? I still think that it's very weird that they never explained how or why Marva died. There was some speculation going around on the Andor subreddit that Marva wasn't really dead, and that she was using this to bring, you know, all of the Empire together, and it was going to be part of a big trap and they were going to spring on the Empire, which sort of maybe makes sense. I just thought it was strange that they never explained how or why she died. She died off screen. There's no explanation. Maybe it doesn't really matter because, you know, her death just served as a way to get everybody back together. It probably doesn't matter in the scope of the larger story. It just kind of seemed weird. They could have just said, I don't know, she had a heart attack and she died, but it seemed like they went out of their way to not say anything, which made me think maybe there was something there. And the last thing, and you guys can tell me if I'm being nitpicky, but who the heck is Uncle Harlow? He's come up like four times. Clearly Cyril's mom is obsessed with this guy. I really thought there was going to be some payoff, like who Uncle Harlow is, you know, he's some high up guy in the ISB or whatever. So those are just some of the minor plot threads that I thought were not tied up in this. Were there any other storylines or anything you think that you wanted to see tied up that didn't make it?
I want to know more about what happens with B2 Emo and Vel. Those are the plot lines I'm looking forward to the most in season two. I hope we just get entire episodes dedicated to those characters.
Wow. Jason?
Well, I was going to get into that, like, in my final thoughts on the episode, I guess. Like, like you said, a lot of those I agreed with. But I think we should talk about the post-credit scene first.
Okay. So here's, I'll go first. We'll do some ratings and then we'll all rate it. And then I will talk about the post-credit scene after we rate it.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Then it'll be post-rating scene. I don't know. Fair enough. So I really like this episode. It had very big vibes to the Aldani heist scene. Like, the pacing was similar and the ramp up was really well done. The tension was drawn out a lot and I really liked it. Unlike Doug, I thought it was really well done and it kept me on the edge of my seat. I just kept waiting for, you know, the ball to drop. The whole thing start to finish was really, really well done. I'm going to give this a 9 out of 10. I would give this a 10 out of 10. This was a fantastic episode. If they had wrapped up a couple other things, if somehow they had tied this back into Cassian's sister, it would have started and ended on the same note. I would have been chef's kiss of a perfect episode.
Okay. 9 out of 10. That's
yeah.
Yeah. That's pretty good. That's kind of where I'm at. I'm going to go a little higher, like 9.5. I guess I'll go over all my final thoughts. I agree. There's like a lot of open threads that we don't have real resolutions for. But as a tangent, I saw like Severance this year, one of my favorite shows that I've seen in many, many years, I think. It ends on such a cliffhanger. I mean, it gives you a lot of like answers to a lot of questions. But like, I listened to an interview by Ben Stiller, who's the producer, creator of that show. And he said specifically he ended the season on a harsh cliffhanger, specifically so that Apple would not cancel his show and give him another season, so because fans would like revolt too much. So that kind of gave me like another like perspective on maybe show creation, on like, okay, maybe that's another factor of why a show would want to make it like just an offer they couldn't refuse to do a new season, you know, especially on fan reaction. So anyway, yes, Cinta and Vel, wish they had more to do. Their relationship just goes nowhere in this episode. You know, why is Cinta there? Like, why does Cinta kill that guy? It doesn't seem to do anything. Yes, I mean, it's obviously that's a thread that's open, but there's just seems like there's missing scenes there. Like you said, Cassian's sister, like, what, you know, question mark there. I would have liked to have seen more of Karn and Daedra, like, what happens after this whole scene, you know, like, what are the next conversations? You know, it's obviously an open thread. And are they going to be, like an Empire power couple after this? You know, they're going to be, like, working together in the Empire and going after the Rebellion, or is Daedra going to reluctantly hire Karn and for like a position, and then he's going to be obsessed with her, and it, you know, what's going on there? You know, hopefully we see more of that. Luthen's plan didn't seem super well thought out. I didn't mind it too much. I felt like I understood I've seen this criticism a lot. Like, why was Luthen even there? Like, what was Luthen even thinking of? But like, there wasn't really many other options. This is the first option. This is the first instance where they could get a hold of Cassian. There's a chance they could get him. So he wanted to be there, and I saw, you know, they didn't do enough with this, but I saw his expressions during the funeral procession and during Marva's speech, where he started like smiling and he started realizing. I think you could tell. He felt like the Rebellion had taken on its own force, its own spark. He lit the fuse, and he feels like his work is done at this point. Like, he really didn't seem too concerned with Cassian or anything, like, after seeing what happened. And I felt that was fairly satisfying, but I wish that was spelled out a little bit more. Mon Mothma getting into bed with Davos Skeldon is just an open thread. I mean, obviously there's going to be more to that. It's not tied up, right? It would be nice to have that closed up or a little bit more explained or something. It was not a definitive endpoint for that storyline. So we'll probably see more of that, but for a finale, you'd hope for more than that. And yeah, exactly. Luthen's wood lightsaber, like a walking stick. Like, what was that? Come on. What was that? And
I wanted that to be something so bad.
Okay, so.
So you're a 9.5.
Yes. I have like many more points here, though.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Don't. Good go.
Are you going to, I mean, we can, you can cut me off. It's fine. It's okay.
No, what do you got? Go.
These are the good things I want to say about this show. Okay. At the beginning of season one, I was pissed about the show being good, like I, and having to watch it because it had to do with Andor and Rogue One, a character from Rogue One that I did not care about. But all the buzz told me this, like, oh God, I got to watch this show. But I thought it was going to be like well done and critically acclaimed, but I wasn't going to be into it. And it was going to be like another detractor like I was with Rogue One. Everyone else seems to like it. But no, I'm super happy with the show. I'm genuinely happy to have watched it. I love the show. I've obviously been a cheerleader. This is Star Wars for adults. You know, the franchise has been walking the line, but has been pretty quickly becoming a children's property. I've talked about the locations, the outfits, the effects, props, all the love and care that went into the show. It feels like it's trying to be practical and be for adults whenever possible. I think the climax in the funeral was, and the ensuing riot is amazing. Nothing gets me more pumped than an anti-fascist uprising. Like, when people really come together for a common good, and that good is killing Nazis, essentially. I mean, there's nothing better than that. I love the ethos of this show. And yeah, that's it. So yeah, 9.5 for the finale. We can talk about the overall show, maybe another point, but yeah.
Wow. Doug, can you follow that up?
10 out of 10. It was great.
What?
I think my views on, I didn't wait for a finale. I made my views known as we discussed the episode. I think part of that is what I said at the very beginning. I was hyped. I was ready for this. I was excited about it. I wanted it to be awesome. I had possibly an impossibly high standard for it. It was a letdown. It wasn't bad. It just wasn't as great as I wanted it to be. I don't know. Still a good episode. I'd still give it probably a solid 8, but I wanted it to be a 10, and it wasn't.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah.
Okay. I think that's, yeah, totally fair. So we've all given our reviews. I do think there was a small post-credit scene. So you want to talk about that, Jason?
Oh, yeah. It's just a sort of a payoff from the whole Narkina 5 arc. We see the little components that Cassian and the whole prison floor was working on being installed on, you know, by like little Autobots or whatever on the Death Star droid. Autobots.
Yes, wrong show.
Wrong show. you know, this is, you know, live long and prosper, you know, right?
Oh, geez. Wow. We're crossing all kinds of universes now.
Make a note on the timestamp of that so you can edit that out, Baker.
I will edit that out, I might add, and make myself not look dumb, I swear. But yeah, this is they're installing the parts on what looks like the planet destroyer part of the Death Star. Am I wrong on that?
So, yeah. No, what we see is some droids doing some soldering, and then it pulls way back, and you see a bunch of droids out in space, and then it pulls back some more, and it pulls back some more, and you realize the scope of how tiny these droids are, and you realize that they're the hexagonal widgets that they were building on Narkina that took 8 guys, you know, to build one. And the camera pulls back and pulls back and pulls back, and you see that these hexagonal widgets essentially hold the plates together that go in the eye part of the Death Star that shoots the laser that kills the planets. So you get it's a really well done scene to indicate the scope of just how large the Death Star is when you can see it up against the widgets. And then that's a star wipe. And that's the final, you know, that's the end of the season. And I do want to note that I did call that I knew it would have something to do with the Death Star. I thought Cassian would be more aware that those were used in the Death Star, and that would, you know, maybe fuel his anger to go after the rebellion and free all the slaves or whatever on Narkina. But ultimately, it did have a reveal, and it did end up being the Death Star. So that is probably the first nod to the larger Star Wars universe, I suppose, other than the Stormtroopers. But that's it. We will be back probably in a week with a season one recap, you know, just sort of a post-mortem on the whole thing. And then maybe we'll also do a Rogue One viewing. It sounds like we've got some time before season two comes out, so we'll be back. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, tune in, Dad and Mom.
All you needed to say at that point was logic gate out, and that was like the perfect ending.
Okay.
Also, go to bed, Bailey. It's way past your bedtime.
Indeed.
Logic gate out.